it's set up. And while you're doing that, I will just state for the record, I will miss the last part of your argument this morning. I will pick that up on tape. I have another obligation that conflicts with this that I have to leave during the middle of argument. But having said that, I have reviewed this and I will listen to the tape so that I'm aware of the portion I missed before any deliberation takes place. With that, Council, if you're ready to go, please do so, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court, Dave Crosby representing Moises Leyva, and good morning to you. At the mediation, Wells Fargo did not provide the assignments required by statute and the rules. The note in deed of trust, Wells Fargo did provide, identified mortgage it as the only party having any interest in those documents or rights thereunder. The mediator, in his mediator statement, found that all of the documents had not been provided. Wells Fargo was nowhere identified to the transaction. The assignments would have bridged that gap, but no assignments were submitted. At the evidentiary hearing, Judge Mosley ruled that Wells Fargo provided all essential documents contrary to the indication of the mediator. That decision was wrong and should be reversed by this court for two reasons. The first reason, that the court had no authority to ignore the statute, as the statute does not distinguish between essential and non-essential documentation. The statute also says that the documents indicated shall be provided.
Mr. Crosby, if I could ask you maybe the response to address it. The Massachusetts Supreme Court has decided a case 3 weeks ago called U.S. National Bank Association versus Ibanez, and there's a discussion here about standing and documents that have to be produced in order to foreclose on a property here. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I'm just curious if either side hasn't had a chance to brief that, but if it's 458 Massachusetts 637 decided January 7, 2011. If you haven't, we can just skip through it, but it is, you know, 3 weeks.
Not aware of it.
Okay, thank you.
Justice Gibbon. There's no room for deviation from these requirements. To the extent that Judge Mosley concluded otherwise, his interpretation of that statute was in error. This court approximately 2 years ago decided a case, Masto versus Montero, where it stated, it is well established that when the language of a statute is plain and unambiguous and its meaning clear and unmistakable, there is no room for construction and the courts are not permitted to search for its meaning beyond the statute itself. So that's our first point of error. The judge should not have tried to construct or become involved in dealing with this statute other than the plain meaning of the statute.
Didn't the foreclosure mediation rules themselves require production of these documents there?
Yes.
At the mediation?
The rules and the statute, okay, both provided. Now, the second point of error was that the judge was legally incorrect. Wells Fargo stated throughout this action that there was no assignment, that they had not brought an assignment, but there has to be an assignment for a stranger to an original transaction to obtain rights under those documents. Otherwise, the third party has no legal standing to foreclose or to participate in the mediation. Judge Riegel in the Mitchell case, 2009, stated, for there to be a valid assignment for purposes of foreclosure, both the note and deed of trust must be assigned. And she cited restatement third of property. Now, neither of these documents were assigned, neither the note or the deed of trust. Wells Fargo had no right under either. Consequently, they have no standing or authority to initiate the foreclosure or participate in the mediation process. Mortgage It was the only legal holder of the note and has never to this date that we know of assigned, transferred, or endorsed the note to any other party.
Who is the true legal obligee on the note?
It would be Mr. Ramos.
Right, and he didn't participate either.
He did participate.
Oh, he did.
Mr. Ramos signed
mediation?
Mr. Ramos signed the election. He was in my office. I had him sign the election so that both parties came to the to the mediation. The way the law reads is the grantor or the person who has title to the property are the eligible participants. Because there was a difference of ownership of the property and the borrower had divested himself of the title, we brought both of them to the transaction. We had both of them sign the election. I represented both of them at the mediation. Mr. Leyva was at the mediation. At the evidentiary hearing, I represented to the court that Mr. Ramos was available by telephone, and Mr. Leyva was in the was before the court. And so both parties participated in the mediation process.
Well, was Mr. Ramos at the mediation?
He was not, but I was his representative there, as the Wells Fargo had their legal representative there. There was not any other person there at the mediation other than their attorney. I also represented Mr. Ramos at that mediation.
Now, Mr. Crosby, when Mr. Ramos signed a quitclaim to Mr. Leyva, so he conveyed all of his right, title, and interest in this property to Mr. Leyva, so he didn't have any fee ownership in the property at the time of the mediation. Is that correct?
That is correct. He still had liability under the note. And
that brings my next question. I'm sorry for jumping around. We have a lot of issues here in this case. But if my question is on the sanctions, and I know we're jumping to a different issue, but if Mr. Leyva was not the original maker of the promissory note and there was no assumption of that note by Mr. Leyva with the lender, what's his standing to request sanctions there, because there's no privity of contract there between the two of them?
Well, I think in the first place we're stating that the bank had no authority, had no standing to participate in the process, nor to have initiated the foreclosure. I think that is a prior requirement before we even get to the question of Mr. Leyva versus the contractual relationship. Certainly, Leyva was a proper participant under the new AB 149 or the 107, 486. In fact, in 30 different places, it says the person who holds title of record, that was Leyva, owner-occupant in 11 different places, homeowner, 2 places, and eligible participant, 5. So
when's the quitclaim deed recorded?
It was recorded in 2007. In other words, Mr. Leyva had owned this property for 2 years. He'd not owned it longer than 2 years, but he had made payments for 2 years to ASC, the servicing agent. They knew who he was. The deed was recorded. They accepted the payments. But when it came time for the mediation, though we had both parties represented, they refused to participate in the mediation, we would say in good faith.
Is there a due on sale clause in the note?
There is a contractual requirement that noted that they must obtain that the borrower must obtain approval. That's a contractual requirement that only the, under the note at least, only the lender can demand or that they accelerate the full amount of the note. The lender is mortgage it, not Wells Fargo. So Wells Fargo couldn't have accelerated that, and mortgage it never did.
Okay. Well, and on that point, the non-monetary or alleged non-monetary default was not a basis for the foreclosure, was it?
No, sir.
On the mediator's statement, when that was provided at the conclusion of the mediation, the mediator is asked to identify if a number of things, but one of them is whether everybody was present who was supposed to be there. Did the mediator's statement in this case indicate that any of the parties who were supposed to be there weren't there?
No, sir. Not that I recall.
The only default then on the mediator statement was that the lender had failed to produce the requisite assignments.
The requisite documents. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So there was never any finding by the mediator, at least, that Mr. Ramos or Leyva were not appropriately present, whether by in person or by representation at the mediation?
No, sir. We had both of them represented there. We figured that's the only way to cover it. And that's why we had both of them sign the election. I represented both of them. I sat down with both of them. We struggled with the concept of what to do in terms of this bifurcation of ownership versus liability under the note. So we brought them both. We felt like the bank can do something. Obviously, the bank, with its legions of the best legal minds in the country, should be able to somehow figure something to come up with this situation and be able to resolve it when all the parties are to the table. I mean, they've got those resources. They've got those capabilities. We felt they had snubbed the process, that they had snubbed the law, and that they hadn't taken it serious. When I look at their documents, I'm of the same opinion, or right, that they've snubbed the process, that they haven't participated in good faith. They haven't dealt with their customer, who is at the table, and then the person they've received payments from for the past 2 years, they haven't given them a fair chance to save this property.
Mr. Crosby, that brings us to another interesting area. What is your view as to what good faith and bad faith is?
Good faith under the Giddings versus Hartz 2000 case by this court equated good faith with meaningful participation. It means more than a warm body appearing at the mediation. The lender must reasonably participate in the mediation in a give-and-take negotiation process, must realistically evaluate and address the economic circumstances of the property and the owner-occupant in the context of the pending foreclosure sale, must reasonably attempt to modify the loan subject of the mediation, including the following: offer more to the homeowner desiring to keep the home and having some reasonable financial capability than an exit strategy and how quick they can get out of the home. Offer more than illusory proposals without substance. Consider or reoffer prior offers without reasonable basis for denial. Have authoritative human evaluation of proposals and negotiation without leaving the matter to a calculator or a computer solely. Have some mechanism, authority, or ability to reduce or defer in some reasonable manner a portion of a loan which is very significantly higher than the present value of the home. It's interesting that the new supplement to the HAMP program introduced in October provides for a principal forgiveness, where the principal in certain cases will be reduced to 115% of the fair market value of the property. We had three of those in December, and it's something that is starting to fit what my thought has been should be the case, that this the total amount of the loan has to be adjusted. I used to think that we could go in one step resolve that problem. I've decided we can't. But when I see that there are deferrals and the deferments, where they take part of the loan, put it on the end, they amortize the front part, the part on the back that's a balloon payment, if you will, draws no interest, there's hope in that also. And that's why I say some deferment or some reduction. I mean, I think that's an element of good faith. Consider proposals of the homeowner.
Are you suggesting that absent a complete restructuring of the loan, that we must necessarily find bad faith?
I think it's only an element. It's something to look at. It's you look at the value of the property. I mean, this property is worth somewhere between 83 and maybe 126. I don't know, but the total amount of the loans, $240,000. I mean, this is not a viable property. I tell my clients, you're either going to lose it now or you're going to lose it later. But if I can buy you time, maybe something will come along that will help you resolve the problem. And so, yeah, that's a problem.
Now, Mr. Crosby, on Giddings versus Hartz, I think I might have been the judge on that case. I have a little bit of recollection. But you're saying that was a de novo request on an arbitration.
That was an arbitration.
Where the court struck the request for trial de novo, and there wasn't good faith participation in the arbitration.
It was
arbitration.
An all-state insurance case, and it was – you're correct.
Yeah. Now, is that – so the good faith, you're saying we should apply that definition of good faith in the foreclosure mediation setting?
Well, I think this is not unlike an arbitration situation where meaningful participation seems to make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And it seems to provide the verbiage that I can relate to in terms of how to evaluate good faith if they meaningfully participate. And the different points that I'm making are points that I think could be factors, and certainly these aren't the only ones, but they're the ones that we've thought about and dealt with the past year and a half.
Could you comment on the extent to which, if at all, the analysis of good faith should be affected by the fact that the person at the mediation was not the obligor on the note, and the lender had no privity with that person.
Absolutely. I think they should extend the same good faith to try to solve the problem. We approach mediation as an attempt to solve problems, not to get overly technical beyond what is necessary to make this loan now a performing loan to provide to the lender as much return as they can. It's a give-and-take process. But when they don't come to the mediation to even go through the give-and-take process, that makes it difficult. Our problem here is it's a bit different because we had a bifurcation of interests. We had Mr. Leyva and Mr. Ramos, but they both participated. Now, why couldn't the bank come up with something other than cash for keys, take a hike kind of mentality? I mean, they could have come up with something. We're dealing with a giant that has capability to...
Counsel, you represented at the mediation that you represented Mr. Ramos.
I did.
So the obligor on the note was present.
That's correct.
Through you.
That's correct. Yeah, he was, and that same was at the evidentiary hearing. On page 40 transcript, you'll see where I told Judge Mosley that Mr. Ramos was available by telephone, and he was available by telephone at the mediation, and I represented him there in the same manner and under the same section of the code that allows the lender to have a representative at the hearing. Shall I continue?
Mr. Crosby, you are out of your assigned time, but the chief in his departure asked that I provide you with a two-minute rebuttal opportunity. Nonetheless, because we did pepper you with a number of questions.
We had asked at the beginning to have a three-minute rebuttal. Certainly.
I understand that. You have used all of your time, but the chief has given me the permission that he would have to give you an additional 2 minutes regardless.
And I make those now or later?
Unless you wish to, you can use them now or you can save them for rebuttal.
I'll save them for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crosby.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Greg Brower for the respondents. Let me try to touch on a few things that were raised and address the issues that the court has indicated it was most interested in, and then, of course, answer any questions. Let me be clear at the outset in clarifying that Mr. Ramos was not at the mediation. I think at the end of counsel's presentation, that was clear to the court, but you heard throughout the presentation references to, you know, he brought Mr. Ramos or this or that. Mr. Ramos was not there.
Well, he was available by telephone, I think, was the representation, if necessary.
That's the representation I heard as well. But he did not provide, either himself or through counsel, any of the required documents, the financials and other documents that would be required from the obligor to allow the beneficiary at such a mediation to evaluate various modification proposals. And so, from the respondent's perspective, the mediation was flawed from the very beginning because the right people weren't in the room. The obligor wasn't there, and so the beneficiary simply could not negotiate with the obligor.
But the,
except through counsel and without the requisite financials there to evaluate the situation.
But the fee owner of the property was there and all, so why couldn't you negotiate with the fee owner of the property?
Well, and there was an attempt, Your Honor, to negotiate and to offer various proposals that would be appropriate to offer to the owner of the property. But, of course, that doesn't take care of the main issue in any case, which is the loan, the relationship, the agreement, the contract between the obligor and the beneficiary. If a mediation is to be successful in terms of a modification of the loan, that can only be done between the obligor and the beneficiary.
Well, on that point, the principal argument, the initial argument that appellant makes is the district court judge in this case said that you essentially complied with the requirement to provide the documents.
Right.
That seems to be the most important issue, at least to begin with. I'd like to clarify factually three things. Was there an assignment of the note and of the deed of trust provided at the mediation to the mediator? Was there an endorsement of the promissory note? I don't see any endorsement in the record furnished. And is it your argument that you were entitled to enforce those instruments regardless or in the absence of an assignment or an endorsement under Article 3 of the Uniform Commercial Code?
The answer, Justice Hardy, to the last question is yes. It's clear, and the answers to the first two is no. The assignment was not provided. No endorsement was provided, as I understand it. But it's clear. It's undisputed, and it was not a matter of dispute at the mediation that the respondents in this case, Wells Fargo, as the loan servicing company, was the holder of the note and was legally able, pursuant to Nevada law, to enforce the note and pursue the foreclosure proceedings. That was not in dispute below.
Had the beneficial interest of the deed of trust been assigned by recorded assignment to Wells Fargo?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I do know that it was clear that Wells Fargo, and again, this was undisputed, was the holder of the note and stood in the shoes of the beneficiary. It was, in effect, the beneficiary, the attorney, in fact, for the beneficiary, for the purpose of the mediation process.
Well, on that score, Mr. Brower, I know that you cited and relied upon 1043301, but is it not the case that NRS 1043201 requires an endorsement as a condition for any lender to enforce a negotiable instrument, not just possession?
I'm not clear on whether such an endorsement was made, Your Honor, as I indicated earlier. That, again, it was not a matter of dispute. The problem with this mediation was not that the obligor through counsel or Mr. Leyva disputed Wells Fargo's ability to modify the loan or disputed the fact that Wells Fargo was the right party to be in the mediation. The problem with the mediation, as we know, is that it just wasn't successful. It didn't result in a satisfactory modification. The mediator, as we know, did not find that that was caused by any bad faith on the part of Wells Fargo, nor did the district court judge. Bad faith has to be more, and getting to the issues raised by the court, bad faith has to be more than simply not being successful. It has to be more than even mistake, negligence, or error in judgment. It has to be more than those things. Black's Law Dictionary, and I'm paraphrasing, discusses bad faith or defines it in terms of conduct involving actual fraud.
Could bad faith be, Mr. Brower, could it be violating the statute and the rules to produce the necessary documents, that is, the note, the assignment of the note, things like this that it discusses in the foreclosure mediation rules? And if you don't do it, perhaps it's bad faith per se, you know, like that. Does that have to be done? Or maybe it's a rebuttable presumption of bad faith. These are the issues we're struggling with here, and we have to define it. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, the failure to produce an assignment in this context, I would submit, cannot be bad faith, because the assignment, the lack of an assignment at this mediation did not cause the mediation to be unsuccessful. It wasn't as though the parties were ready, willing, and able to reach a resolution, but the obligor, because he wasn't there through counsel, or Mr. Leyva, just couldn't agree, couldn't go all the way because there was a question as to an assignment. That was not the problem. So the assignment issue, if you will, was irrelevant to this process. Now, the mediator did check that box, but the fact that he didn't check the bad faith or lack of good faith box, I think, is telling. And it's also telling, of course, that upon a full evidentiary hearing, the district court judge agreed that there was no bad faith. And I think, perhaps more importantly, decided that the lack of a production of the assignment just didn't matter to this particular mediation. Not only was it not important to the process, but it was not evidence of bad faith.
Mr. Crosby made the argument that Wells Fargo had no right to foreclose because they didn't have the proper documents to authorize the execution recording of the notice of default and election to sell. Without the proper assignments, doesn't he have a valid point there that they don't even have a right? The foreclosure should never have taken place to start with, you know, because of the absence of the necessary legal documents.
Well, that was not an issue below. And, in fact, Wells Fargo made it clear by producing the note and the deed of trust and producing an affidavit from one of its employees that it was the holder of the note and, as a result, authorized to pursue the foreclosure. That status is not what held up or caused this mediation to be unsuccessful.
So let me ask this. If that were to be challenged at the mediation level, what is the remedy if you're not if you don't produce the note or an assignment? Then does that delay the proceedings further until the assignment can be produced?
I guess if the Justice Perrieri, if the mediator felt that the absence of an assignment was a critical problem and was holding up a successful mediation, then I guess the mediation could be continued or reconvened upon the production of an assignment. But that's not what happened here. And the district court judge, as we know, did not find that the absence of an assignment was in any way an obstacle to a successful mediation in this case. This mediation was, as we know, unsuccessful.
Well, but
many of them will be.
Do you concede that what was brought to the mediation was not technically in compliance with NRS 107.086, subparagraph 4?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your argument is that the noncompliance didn't amount to bad faith and was technical and caused no injury. Is that your argument?
That is our argument, and I guess to put a finer point on it, that was the argument below. The argument today, of course, is that Judge Mosley did not err in so finding, and he should not, as a result, he should not be reversed as a result. There's no evidence in the record that the mediator erred in not finding bad faith, and that Judge Mosley erred in not finding bad faith. And that result should not be reversed.
What would be the test that differentiates statutory noncompliance from bad faith?
Well, I think in the typical case, if you had statutory noncompliance that amounted to bad faith, we would see either a finding of bad faith on the part of the mediator and or a finding of bad faith on the part of the district court judge upon a petition for judicial review.
I don't think I was clear. What would be the test that would distinguish statutory noncompliance from bad faith? In other words, what's the bad faith test when you have an incident of statutory violation?
I think I understand, Your Honor. I think you would have to have a situation in which the statutory noncompliance amounts to, as I paraphrased earlier, amounts to an intent to mislead. Conduct involving fraud, a refusal to fulfill some duty by a sinister motive, something that's done which both is a technical violation of the statute and essentially undermines the entire process, thereby making the process unsuccessful from the beginning. I think that would be a situation where bad faith could be found by the mediator and or by the district court judge. But we know that that wasn't the case here. Neither the mediator nor the district court judge, upon looking at the totality of the circumstances revolving around the mediation, found that the respondents acted in bad faith. The mediation was unsuccessful, but it wasn't because of any bad faith on the part of anybody. So that I think, is the bad faith, good faith argument. With respect to...
And what's the standard of review for which you would contend from this court?
Well, I would suggest clearly erroneous as a standard. In the absence of clear error on the part of the district court judge, it seems to me that a finding of no bad faith should be affirmed, and that's exactly what confronts the court today. Unless the court has any further questions, I will rest.
Colleagues?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Troy Fox on behalf of Mr. Leyva for our two-minute rebuttal. I think one of the important points that we distinguish here is that our understanding of the statute is that we have essentially set up two tiers of compliance. This court has asked what should be the standard of review, and I think it depends on exactly what the question being asked is. What I mean by that is the statute has said the lender must produce certain documents. They must produce the note, the deed of trust, the assignments. They must appear at the mediation, and they must have authority. Those are simply statutory requirements. Failure to do so prevents the foreclosure mediation, prevents them from being able to receive their certificate by statute. It's a strict compliance. And this court should review whether or not those things have been provided under a de novo standard. It's simply taking the statute and citing whether or not it's being followed. It's a statutory interpretation. It should be reviewed under a de novo standard. The question of good faith is a separate question. That is, taking all factors into consideration at what occurred at the mediation, did the parties participate in good faith or not? Bad faith being essentially the opposite of it. And to the point that Judge Mosley conflicted or simply mushed them all together is where he was clearly erroneous in looking at this statute and interpreting it and applying it properly.
So do you say that a technical violation of 086 subparagraph 4 requires a finding of bad faith? Isn't that essentially the argument you're making?
It's not a finding of bad faith. It's a finding that they failed to comply with the statute and therefore cannot receive their certificate. It in and of itself does not mean bad faith. In these mediations, often there are issues that arise with whether or not there are endorsements, whether or not there are proper assignments, and that shouldn't prevent the parties from still trying to reach some kind of agreement. Nonetheless, the mediators mark on this statement and even on the current statement that the proper documents were not provided, and at that point, the certificate stops. To the same extent, if the lender shows or if the homeowner shows up and fails to provide proper documents, the mediator might determine the same thing.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your appearances today. The matter stands submitted. We'll reconvene at 1:30.